address that. Let me say some things to start off being provocative, and I will get to those questions. There's this major question there. Look, I don't know about how you went into physics or why you're, I assume that you're interested in going into physics. Let me tell you why I went into physics, and this will maybe, then I'll get to loop quantum gravity and quantum gravity in general. I grew up in the United States. I'm from New York. I grew up in Cincinnati. I was a teenager in Cincinnati. I wanted to be a writer, then I wanted to be a rock and roll star, then I wanted to be an architect. And I wanted to be an architect because I heard a talk by somebody called Buckminster Fuller. Who, have any of you heard of him? He was an inventor and an all-around interesting person who had invented the idea of making buildings. If you've seen geodesic domes, buildings made out of spheres with triangulated, he invented those. He invented a lot of other things. And I wanted to work with buildings with curved roofs and curved, kind of like Frank Gehry eventually did. With where you could have it, if you, how many of you have heard of Frank Gehry? That's even worse. He's one of your, he's one of the world's leading architects. But I wanted to make buildings with arbitrary curved surfaces rather than be restricted to flat walls and flat ceilings. And I was in a strange situation which was related to the times, which were pretty turbulent. I dropped out of high school. I, however, had access to an early computer. This was the days before personal computers, when to get use a computer, you had to either be part of a company or be part of a university that had a computer. And I had, from the age of 10, this is not unusual now, but it was unusual then, from the age of 10, been programming in Fortran. And I had also gotten advanced in mathematics, mostly because the school I went to said that I wasn't good enough in mathematics to do mathematics. So I did calculus the next year. That was when I was 12 or 13. Just to, because we were all rebels in those days, to try to show them up. So I was writing some codes which helped me triangulate curved surfaces and calculate stresses and strains on triangulations of curved surfaces. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to make a living doing that since I was 17 and out of high school, dropped out of high school. And I was, because I was a little bit advanced in mathematics, I was studying differential geometry, which is the mathematics of how to do calculus on curved surfaces. And I got sort of interested in this idea of relativity because many of the books that I was taking, and I was just getting books from the public library with my library card. And many of the books that I got out of the library had a chapter on general relativity, on space and time and curved space, time and stuff, and I found that pretty interesting. So I went back to the library and I got a book about Albert Einstein. It was actually a collection of essays dedicated to him called Albert Einstein, Philosopher, Scientist. And in that, there was a short essay of about 80 pages by Einstein himself called Autobiographical Notes. And I took that out of the library. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't understand it. So I was sitting around, but one night, it was a spring night because it was warm. I had a date and I got stood up. And so I had nothing to do. My parents were out. So I opened the book and I was sitting on the porch. And I started to read this narrative by Einstein, who I had heard, of course, of. About why he went into physics. And he described himself as pretty, of course, he had a good reason to be cynical and disappointed. He was writing at close to the age of 70 after living through the world wars, the First World War and the Second World War and so forth. And so he was pretty bitter about human life and said that life is short and difficult and a struggle, but there's this true beautiful world of natural phenomena beyond human existence. And if you're a scientist, you can kind of transcend the ugliness of human life and get to know something about the transcendent beauty of nature and express it in mathematics, which is timeless. And I fell for that. I should say, I don't really believe that anymore. That is, I think that human life is pretty good, and I'm pretty optimistic about human beings. And I'm actually very optimistic about the future of humanity, which none of us were then. I also somehow have enjoyed being a human being tremendously. So I'm not in that frame of mind, but at the age of 17, I was very much in that frame of mind. It appealed to me. So I kept reading. And pretty much after sort of spending a few more personal things, he turned to physics. And he described what he thought he had achieved. Remember, he was writing this at the age of 70. And what he hadn't achieved. And what he hadn't achieved in his mind was two important things. One of them was the unification of physics, because he had invented the theory of gravity, which was general relativity. And he had failed to make a unification of that with anything else in nature. He'd spent many years trying to unify it with electromagnetism, with matter, and had failed, or not succeeded. And the other thing is that he, even though he was the person who first clearly pointed to the necessity for a radical break of classical physics that had to be quantum physics, in 1905, in his paper about photons and so forth and the wave-particle duality, he had clearly pointed to the need for quantum physics. He had not believed quantum mechanics when it was invented. He was in strong disagreement with quantum mechanics as it was developed by Heisenberg and Schrodinger and so forth. And he was sure it was incomplete at best. And so he, for him, the legacy that he was most worried about was that finding out how to have a sensible way to think of quantum phenomena was unfulfilled. It was, quantum mechanics didn't make any sense to him. So those were the two things that he felt he left unfinished, the unification of physics and the making sense of quantum mechanics. And for some crazy reason, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, I mean, I was just sitting there reading this on the porch this spring night, and I just thought, oh, I could work on that. Not that I didn't think I could succeed, but I thought, this is a wonderful challenge. I thought, I knew people from hanging around the math department and the computer science group at the university, which was nearby. I knew there were people who were a lot brighter than me, who were people who were much better mathematicians, much better computer coders. So I knew I had limitations. But I thought, these questions are such a challenge that it doesn't matter how bright you are, because nobody's bright enough. Nobody has a guarantee of being able to make any progress on these challenges. So I thought, this is a good challenge. I'll work on those things. And that was just decided. It took a few minutes to just come to the conclusion that was what I was going to do. I wasn't going to be an architect. I was going to be a theoretical physicist and work on the unification of physics and making sense of quantum mechanics. And my only problem was how to get into graduate school, because I understood you had to get into graduate school, and I hadn't managed to graduate from high school. But those were just practical, you know, pragmatic issues. And pretty much that's what I did. Now, I didn't solve either problem. I did help invent a few approaches, including quantum gravity, which are approaches to the problem of unifying. And by the way, notice he didn't say quantum gravity was a problem, because he didn't believe in quantum mechanics, so he didn't think that you had to quantize gravity. He thought you had to gravitize quantum mechanics. And given that we haven't succeeded at quantizing gravity fully, maybe he was right, but I'll leave that for you guys to work on. So that's some time ago. And about the same time as I was sitting on that porch, physicists were developing the Standard Model, which had recently been invented a few years before that. And the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which is our governing model of elementary particle physics and all the forces except gravity, So then I did manage, I lucked out and I went to a great undergraduate school and had a great undergraduate teacher. I went to Hampshire College. And then I really got lucky and got into a decent graduate school. So I got a good training, which is important. And I'm having a decent career as a theoretical physicist. But meanwhile, we have not made sense of quantum mechanics. We have not unified physics. We have not, in fact, made any definitive step past the Standard Model. We have six or eight interesting approaches to quantum gravity, not just string theory and loop quantum gravity, but several others. Each of the approaches to quantum gravity has some really cool result, which is cool enough to make people loyal. That is to make people think this must be the answer and devote their life to it. And each approach to quantum gravity also has a persistently unsolved problem, which makes people outside that little group say, that can't possibly be right. And so that's where we are. We've got these approaches. We have no experiments. That's not quite true, but we have experiments. But the experiments that we have not discovered any quantum gravity phenomenon. They've had boring results like all the other experiments, like the LHC only found the Higgs and didn't find anything else, except maybe this resonance is 750 JeV, but the rumor is that's about to go away. So we've done nothing but confirm the Standard Model. We've got the most boring cosmology imaginable. And we have no experimental evidence of quantum gravity phenomena, which I could tell you much more about any of these things. So there's a lot to do. And you guys have fabulous opportunities to revolutionize physics because in other words, here's one way to look at it. Einstein, in 1905, started a revolution which left Newtonian physics, which is the previous physics, in the dust. That revolution had two prongs, relativity and quantum mechanics. Okay. That revolution is not over. To be over would require making sense of quantum mechanics and having a single theory related to unifying quantum mechanics and relativity, not different theories for different domains of phenomenon. So the revolution that Einstein started is still suspended in the air, half done. So this is your opportunity. Or if you think of it historically, when was the last time there was a revolution like this? The last time there was a revolution like this was the transition from Ptolemaic physics to Newtonian physics. It started in 1540, if I remember right. Does anybody know the publication of Copernicus's book saying that the sun doesn't orbit the earth, the sun is near the center of the universe and the earth goes around the sun. And that started a revolution. It took 140 years till that revolution was closed by Newton's Principia, Newton's great book, which was 1687, if I remember right. Little aside, if you want to be a physicist, don't trust anybody for the history. Read these people yourself. I mean very seriously, if you want to be a physicist, go back, read Copernicus, read Kepler, read Galileo, read Newton, read Maxwell, read Boltzmann, read Mach, read Einstein, read Feynman, read Bohr, read Heisenberg. Don't trust your teachers. Don't get this thing from the classroom. Get this thing as a living historical tradition from the people who made it. And that's one thing I did do because I had the good luck to go to a little college with a great teacher. So anyway, it took 140 years from Copernicus to Newton. That was the span of that revolution. Where 111 years from 1905, maybe the current state is something like the state of that previous revolution after Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus and Descartes and a few others, Huygens, etc., but not yet Newton. So there's a fabulous opportunity for you guys if you're serious. It's a huge risk. It'd be a lot easier to, you know, go into medical research or neuroscience or something where there's guaranteed to be progress. But that's my viewpoint. We're halfway through a revolution, and the culmination is yet to come and is likely to be done by somebody in your generation. Okay, next question. So just somebody else, in case somebody else has another question. I will get back to loop quantum gravity.
I have a different question as well.
Yeah?
It's also a general question. So we heard that you actually are also a professor of philosophy. So what sort of, I mean, was it the physics that came first and that opened a lot of questions for philosophy? Or did you also have a philosophy in mind so that physics was a way of kind of, you know, like answering the questions you had?
I'll answer generally, and then I'll answer personally if you're interested. I'm not a historian, but from my study of history, there are different periods of physics in which different kinds of thinking are called for. This was inspired by, if you're interested in the history of science, a very important, and philosophy of science, a very important person to read is Paul Feyerabend, who was originally from Vienna, an Austrian philosopher of physics. He died about 10 years ago. And he argued that there is no scientific method. Scientists are opportunists and they do whatever it takes to further knowledge, to extend knowledge in whatever situation they face, but there's no rules. The rules are whatever you can get away with. Of course, it's mostly good to invent theories that agree with experiments, but every once in a while the experiments are wrong, so you could only make progress by inventing a theory that disagrees with the experiment. Also, very often the crucial experiment isn't sitting there waiting for you, waving at you, saying, hi, I'm the crucial experiment. The crucial experiment is realized as crucial after the invention of a theory that conflicts with the governing theory that opens up a hole which has to be decided by an experiment. So anyway, Feyerabend says, there are different styles of research which are different of use at different times. So during revolutions, it helps to have real philosophical depth. The people who made people like Einstein, if you go too far in the past, there's not a difference between philosophy and science. But if you in the present period, they are very different. The people who pursue academic philosophy think very differently than people who pursue academic science. But people like Einstein, Bohr, Schrodinger, Heisenberg were deeply steeped in the history of philosophy and the general history of thought. They knew what they were doing from a global, large perspective. They knew what they were doing from this perspective of the whole, going back to the Greeks and before the Greeks, the whole history of thought. And you read them and they talk about Leibniz and Spinoza and Kant and Descartes and Plato and so forth and Aristotle, because that's how they were educated. Once things are set in motion and the foundations are frozen, at least for a while, you need a different kind of scientist. You need a pragmatist who doesn't care about philosophical problems, who doesn't get confused by the meaning of things, but can apply things that are on the table. So, for example, read Freeman Dyson, who's a very important transitional figure. He was the person who proved that the different approaches to quantum field theory developed by Feynman and Schwinger and others in the 1940s were all talking about the same thing. He's also a wonderfully articulate writer. And Freeman writes that usually the young people are revolutionaries and the old people are conservatives, but in my period, he's talking about the 1950s to the present period, the old guys like, you know, Heisenberg and Bohr and Einstein, who are still around when he was young, are radicals. They're the old revolutionaries. And my generation, we're the conservatives because we're tired of listening to people argue about what quantum mechanics means. We're sick of these guys going at each other over philosophical problems. We just want to take these tools and apply them to atomic physics and nuclear physics and condensed matter physics and particle physics. So the period that followed the revolutionary periods tend to be philosophical, and then what Thomas Kuhn, another important historian, calls normals periods, when you just develop what he called a paradigm, are pragmatic. And then you have people like, of course, Freeman is really a very sophisticated pragmatist because he's conscious enough to know what he's doing. So Feynman knew exactly what he was doing. Feynman led the turn to pragmatism. He was the first generation of North American physicists who took over the leadership of science from the European physicists who were too philosophical and too compromised by all the old arguments. But you have to also see Feynman as, if any of you study the history of art, you have to see Feynman as analogous to the generation of the abstract expressionists, who were the first generation of painters and sculptors who took over from the European artists centered in Berlin and Paris and so forth, and made the center of art New York City, which gave it a very American pragmatist anti-foundational strategy. Okay, so Feynman was like de Kooning, and had a very similar background, had very similar history. Feynman, by the way, painted. And you look at his paintings and they're abstract expressionists. Indeed, there were people have listened to Feynman's humor and traced it to certain bars in New York where he got those jokes, where also the painters and so forth hung out. There's a lot of interesting crosstalk that way. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. Feynman, but the point is that Feynman was and Dyson were the great charismatic leaders who led the turn to pragmatism. My personal sense is that that pragmatic approach broke down in the 70s, which is when we stopped making progress. Everything that we know now that is assured, i.e. the standard model of particle physics, the standard model of cosmology, goes back to the 1970s. And that's when the pragmatic approach broke down, and we need again, in my view, a more philosophical approach. But then again, there's plenty of people like me who are philosophical, and we haven't succeeded either, so who knows? Anyway, I didn't start off interested in philosophy. I met a teacher in college. I briefly wanted to do neuroscience, and I got kind of intellectually seduced by a teacher who was a neuroscientist who was also very interested in philosophy of mind, and that got me interested in philosophy. And then just as I was getting my PhD, I spent the summer working in Oxford, England, around Roger Penrose. Roger is the person who's made the most contribution to relativity theory since Einstein, and is one of the great creative minds of our time. And I was bothering Roger a lot about space and what space really was and what's time and what's the meaning of time and what does relativity really mean? Why does general relativity have this huge coordinate invariance and why the coordinates don't matter? And he finally said that, look, if you're over my head, if you really want to think about the foundation of space and time, there's a guy called Julian Barber who lives out in the countryside and you ought to go see him. So with a friend, we phoned up Julian and took a train out and saw him. He's a guy who lives in a little village and is a strong rooting in history and philosophy of science, as well as an important leader in science. He's become since an important leader in science. And I spent the afternoon talking with Julian, and Julian finally said, you know, if you really want to understand what general relativity means, you have to go back to Leibniz and understand the idea of relational space and time as aspects of relations rather than as absolute as Newton. So Leibniz, and I said, who was Leibniz? I really did. I had no idea who Leibniz was, which shows that I really was badly educated. And Leibniz was a scientist and a philosopher at the time of Newton, who opposed Newton's ideas about space and time being absolute, argued that they were just aspects of relationships, and laid the groundwork for Mach and Einstein to invent general relativity. Leibniz also invented symbolic calculus, scoped out the notion of a computer, invented calculus independently, and did 5 or 10 other things of major import. And under Julian's tutelage, I began to read Leibniz and Mach and other philosophers of space and time. And when we came time to make loop quantum gravity, working with Abhay Ashtekar and Carlo Rovelli, we found those ideas very helpful. At a technical level, how to construct operators that are quantum operators that act in the Hilbert space, which is the right Hilbert space for quantum gravity, how to get rid of the infinities and so forth. We found the inspiration of Leibniz and Mach and Einstein very helpful. So I found philosophical thinking useful for the work that I wanted to do. There another question?
Yes, it was more about gravity. So
okay.
I'm not into this question very much. And it seems to relate in a way to diffeomorphisms. Morphisms. So maybe what you reference that you can pull the fields over a space-time manifold, and then the physics which happens is invariant. And I just wanted to know how loop quantum gravity relates to this phenomenon. Which seems to be very important for general relativity, so which is also covariance.
So there are two issues. One of them is, and these issues are come from this tradition I was just calling out. They ultimately go back to Leibniz and to Leibniz's opposition to Newton. One of them is that there should be no fixed background structures, that when you define the laws of nature, everything should be dynamical. Any structure you have to use, whether it's the geometry of space, say, let's say the geometry of space should be dynamical. It shouldn't be fixed. There should be nothing that's fixed and frozen with respect to which other things move. And that was the message from Leibniz and Locke, and which Einstein realized in general relativity. Related to that is gauge invariance, the notion of gauge invariance. So gauge invariance must seem a very... can I talk about Maxwell's equations? So in Maxwell's equations, there's an E and B field. But under it, you know about the vector potential? The B field is the curl of the vector potential. The vector potential is a simpler object than the E field or the B field. And the laws of electromagnetism are really most simply understood in terms of the vector potential, which is a vector. That sits at every point in space. And rather than two vectors, an E and a B field, there's really just one vector, which is related. You take derivatives of this vector and you get the E field or the B field. Okay. I can see, looking at you, that this is going over your head as bright as you guys are. So let me skip it. There can be, in mathematics and physics, two different ways of describing a situation which appear to be different, but which really describe the same situation. When that happens, we say it's a gauge invariance. It's not a symmetry, it's a redundancy of the description. Now, you know what a diffeomorphism is because you asked the question, or I'm presuming you know, but probably not everybody knows what a diffeomorphism is. Diffeomorphism is a huge redundancy in the description of space, of the geometry of space, that says that there's really no background geometry. That's really what's saying. It's ruling out, it's making impossible talking about there being some fixed geometry. It requires that the geometry be dynamical. Let me give you an analogy. Supposing you have a system with five particles interacting, you give the position of the particles in three-dimensional space, and then you give the forces between them, and then you write down Newton's laws. But that seems to be, there's something creepy about that. Supposing you move them all over 10 feet to the left, would you be describing the same system or a different system? This is a question for you. Supposing I gave the positions of I have a system of five particles. I give their positions in as they change in time. And then I move and I describe that system. And then I take that whole thing and I move it 10 feet to the left. Is that a different system or the same system? Well, it depends, but let's assume, because if there's something else in the universe that doesn't get moved, then you've changed something. But if the whole system, if the whole universe were those five particles, it would be the same system. And that's what Leibniz said explicitly. He said, if you move the whole universe 10 feet to the left, you wouldn't change anything, so it can't matter where the universe is. The only thing that can matter is the relative positions of the particles, not where they are with respect to some absolute notion of space. And Newton replied and said, no. And this is literally the argument. Newton said, God can tell the difference. And no, don't laugh, because for Newton, look, Newton was the greatest physicist who ever lived, slightly better than Einstein even. And for Newton, his invention of Newtonian physics was an act of homage to the God he believed in. So don't laugh. We may not be so religious, many of us now, some of us are. But the history of Christianity and the history of physics are deeply intertwined. And don't don't ignore that if you want to understand. And I mean not just religion in general, but Newton was a deeply religious Christian and it mattered. I'm not a scholar and I can't go into that, but when Newton said, God can tell where the particles really are, he meant it, and because of that, he can make a dynamics that made sense. He wrote down Newton's laws and you can solve them and describe everything. Leibniz, who had the deeper philosophy, he said only the relations between the particles should matter, which was deeper and turned out eventually to be true in general relativity. Leibniz, however, who was also religious but had a different religion, was unable to make the progress that Newton made. So it's not always that the people with the right philosophy do the right thing for science. Anyway, if you get the picture, the redundancy in using the positions of the particles relative to a fixed space is like a diffeomorphism. It's a redundancy, it doesn't affect the description of the system, but the math looks different, the numbers, the coordinates are different. So that's what we call a gauge symmetry, and diffeomorphism is an example of a gauge symmetry. So when we made loop quantum gravity is basically a quantization of general relativity. It's a quantization of general relativity with general relativity written in a form in which it looks like electromagnetism, in which the fundamental field is not the geometry of space, it's something like an electromagnetic field. And this was done by Abhay Ashtekar, who is a great friend who's actually visiting somewhere in the building right now. And then we took that and used techniques that people had used in particle physics to describe the quantum mechanics of electric and magnetic fields and related fields for the strong interaction. We took those techniques from particle physics and applied them to quantized gravity as it was described by Abhay Ashtekar, and that became loop quantum gravity. And I can even tell you what the loops are. Nobody asks, what are the loops, which is the first question you should ask. Yes.
And that he had an image which was very pretty easy for me to like visualize it, but so he basically used key rings and then he connected them over again, like these type of key rings over here, and
yes,
he interconnected them to form but like a meshwork.
I was there when we made that little thing with key rings together.
So like my understanding is really low, but
no, let me tell you what the loops are, because Carla didn't tell you what the loops are. And again, it's obvious from the way I'm speaking, the history of ideas matters to me. And one reason, by the way, you asked about philosophy and history. David Finkelstein, who was a great role model for me, who died a few months ago, was the first person, by the way, who figured out what an event horizon of a black hole was in 1959. Was also a very philosophical physicist. And David used to say that the reason why we need philosophy and history of science is we want to make a big jump. And if you want to make a big jump, it helps to go back and get a running start. And going back, see, if you don't study history and philosophy, if you just learn what's in the textbooks and what they teach you in graduate school, your vision of what's going on in your subject is 5 years deep. Nobody tells you anything with a perspective that's older than 5 years. If you want to get a real perspective of what's happening in the field historically, you need a running start. You need to go back 100, 200, 500 years and know what happened. At least you need to be able to go back 50 years in detail and know what happened so you can get some good momentum. So look, has everybody heard of superconductivity? Okay, does somebody know what happens to the magnetic field in a superconductor? What?
It has a zero value inside a superconductor.
Yes, it gets repelled, but there can be a line of magnetic flux that gets trapped in a superconductor. That's a quantum of magnetic flux. So the field lines of a magnetic field become discrete and quantum in a superconductor. Now, in the strong interactions, there's quantum chromodynamics, which is something like electromagnetism, but with more bells. There's three different kinds of charges that can interact with each other, and not just one kind of charge. but there's still magnetic fields and electric fields. And one way that people early tried to understand why the quarks are confined within the proton and neutron and the meson and so forth is if the quarks have strings between them. And the strings are lines of electric flux, which are quantized, not magnetic flux. So we say that empty space for the quantum chromodynamic force, follow me here, is like the dual of a superconductor. The electric flux is quantized and not the magnetic flux. And if you can imagine networks of electric flux, of quantized electric flux, that would form into loops. There might be graphs where at the ends of the intersections of the graphs you put the charged particles. And that's what the loops in the networks are. Now, Vyashtakar said general relativity is just like electromagnetism and quantum chromodynamics, only the electric magnetic fields have to do with the curvature and the geometry of space-time and not the electromagnetic fields. And so I took Abai's formalism and the ideas about quantizing electric flux from gauge, from quantum chromodynamics and particle physics, and put them together, and that's what the loops are. The loops are loops of quantized gravitational electric flux. And they form into networks, which we got wrong at the beginning. We just had loops. And by the way, this quantum spacetimes with just loops had no volume, and we thought that was pretty cool for a while, and then we thought, well, how do you put volume in? And we realize you put volume in by making the loops intersect, and then you have graphs and networks. And then, by the way, you have a picture that looks a lot like what happens if you triangulate a surface and try to make architecture from curved surfaces. You have curved spaces that are broken up into discrete elements that look a lot like graphs. But it was only when somebody was writing a story, a journalist was writing a story about loop quantum gravity, that I realized that. Anyway, you had another question.
So in the beginning of the first half of what you said that, like, I'm just curious, why would you say that we have the most boring cosmology?
Oh, we have lambda, what's our cosmology? 4% baryons, roughly 20-something percent dark matter, which we don't know what it is, 70% dark energy, which we definitely don't know what it is. The parameters, has Neil Turk given you a speech? I was really referencing that speech of Neil. The universe, when it starts off, is absent, and the universe looks very regular. You look in every direction, and you see the cosmic microwave background radiation coming at you. It's the same temperature up to a part in 100,000. It's a pure thermal spectrum up to parts in thousands at least. Okay, it looks the same in every direction. There's no differences between looking in different directions up to a few parts in 100,000. That's boring. It seems that the universe at the beginning started off highly regular, highly homogeneous, highly symmetrical with just tiny little ripples on it. Why did it start out that way? It's not that way now. It's full of inhomogeneities, big stars, galaxies, clumps of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, planets. The universe is very complicated now, but it was very simple when it started off. Why? What enforced that simplicity? Is that related to the arrow of time? Is that related to the fact that entropy only increases? Is that related to the fact that we remember the past and foresee the future, but not the reverse? Is that related to the fact that when we look out and see the stars, we say we're seeing light from the past? We never say, oh, we're getting light from the stars in the future. But why is that? What makes this the asymmetry between past and future? And are all these different asymmetries between the past and future connected to each other? Nobody knows. Nobody knows why the universe was so simple at the beginning, but it was extraordinarily simple. There were no black holes at the beginning, as far as we know. If you estimate, if you say the universe was created by chance, and imagine there's a piece of paper whose points are the possible states that the universe could start off in. So we can describe in some language what could be the possible initial states of a universe, something like ours. And then we say, where's the region in this space where a universe would come out as regular, as symmetrical, and as simple as our universe? It's a tiny little region off in the corner. What's the area of that region, or the volume of that region compared to the whole? It's something like one part in 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 200. Okay, the universe as it started out is, how did it start out randomly? It's extraordinarily improbable it would be like it was. Again, why is that? Who set the initial conditions? How were the initial conditions set? And is that related to the arrow of time, to entropy and probability, et cetera? Let me throw in another question on top of all that. Who chose the laws? And what were the, what you learn in, you're learning now about the laws of physics, there's electromagnetism, the strong force, the weak force, the various quarks and leptons, okay? But there's a structure you can learn to describe, and probably you guys know the basics of it, the four forces, the quarks, the leptons, et cetera, the 29 numbers which parameterize the masses and the strengths of the different forces of the different particles. Who chose those numbers? Who chose four forces? Who chose that gravity would be there and would be the weakest? Who chose that the strong interactions would be the strongest? Why the weak interactions? Why do the weak interactions break parity? There's symmetry between left and right hand. And only the weak interactions. These are all questions that have been questions for almost 100 years, and nobody knows the answer to them. We know the laws, we know how to describe them down, we know what will come out of the LHC and all the other experiments, but we don't know why we live in the universe we live in. Okay, Mark, next question. Yeah?
Speaking of questions, which of these questions do you think could be answered within, say, the next 100 years?
All of them. But let me tell you, if it doesn't flip you out, let me tell you what I think the answer to a lot of them is going to look like. I think the big mistake is to think that the laws are fixed. I think we're in the same, if you think the laws are fixed, answering the questions of why these laws is just like being before Darwin and trying to explain why there are the different species you find on Earth. I think the laws, they change and evolve, they have a dynamics. And the way to answer all these questions is to untangle the dynamics of the laws. That's what I think. There was another question. Yeah.
What other questions would you like to see answered in the near future?
Well, I mentioned the foundations making sense of quantum mechanics, quantum gravity, why the laws of nature are what they are, all the questions about why they are what they are. How about the origin of life? That's a physics question. How about why the universe is hospitable to life? It's not hard to see if you, let me show you, if you want to entertain yourself, here's a puzzle. Take the laws as you know them and change something. Make the electron 10 times heavier. Make the electric charge 1/10 of its value. Throw in a whole bunch more elementary particles who are lighter than any of the particles, the quarks, electrons that we have. Give the neutrinos big masses. Make gravity 1,000,000 times stronger. Okay. Just randomly mess with the laws. Then ask two questions. One, why couldn't it have been this way according to physics? In almost all cases, there's no answer. The laws of physics would be as consistent as the present laws with these changes. Question two, would a universe with these changed laws allow life? The answer is almost always no. For example, almost everything that you do destabilizes most atomic nuclei. So almost anything you do ends up in a world with just hydrogen. Or if you make the neutron lighter than the proton rather than the reverse, just neutrons. That's enough questions. But the origin of life is a good question. Why, you know, solve neuroscience, figure out the principles by which the brain gives rise to a mind. But that's outside, that's a biology question. And I'm not sure that's a 100-year question. And while you're at it, some of you ought to figure out how to forestay global warming. Yeah?
How do you explain that if there is no black hole in the universe will die?
How do I explain that? Well, who says that?
I read recently on a website, it said it's your idea.
I never talked about the universe dying. I took an idea which was an idea of somebody called Bryce DeWitt, who was one of the founders of the field of quantum gravity, who told me his idea that black holes may not be singular at the inside, but instead you may continue through where the singularity would be to a new universe. It's called the baby universe idea. And I took that, I made a theory of universes giving birth to other universes and so forth, but it never died. The only good thing about that theory, I mean, was it taught me to think about the laws changing and the laws evolving, because I had the laws mutate each time a new universe was born. So it liberated me to think about that. And it made actually two testable predictions. And testable predictions are really rare these days. So it was a theory that could be wrong, which is the best I've done, unfortunately. Yeah?
To ask, what are just like the, in general, the testable predictions of quantum gravity?
The predictions of quantum gravity?
That could be experimentally validated or validated.
Pure loop quantum gravity, I'm trying to parse several possibilities here. Loop quantum gravity, unfortunately, doesn't just cleanly make predictions that are easily testable. Let me tell you two things which might be predictions of loop quantum gravity. And I'm saying this humbly because they might not be, and it's embarrassing to be in this situation. But I'll give them to you anyway. One of them has to do with the black hole singularities bouncing. And it's an idea which has been developed by Francesca Vidato and Carlo Rovelli and a few other people, that maybe black holes bounce and explode and turn into white holes. So rather than sitting there and evaporating via Hawking evaporation, which is boring forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, at least the time proportional to the cube of the mass, which is many, many, many orders of magnitude times the lifetime of the Hubble scale, a black hole would relatively quickly, as with a time only that goes like the mass squared, explode back in looking like a white hole, which is the reverse of a black hole. And this might be seen in what are called fast radio pulses, which are fast radio bursts, which are an unknown, a kind of signal that's been seen in radio telescopes recently, which is unknown. But this is very new stuff. The other stuff, the reason why I hesitated, there are different forms of loop quantum gravity. I know this sounds like hedging, but this is what happens historically. And there was an earlier form called the Hamiltonian form that appeared to make a prediction of the following sort. If you send light through material, it distorts, it diffracts. And that's because the speed of light is different in different materials. So if you look in a swimming pool, the angle changes because of the matching the boundary conditions for the light passing through the material with different speeds. Well, if you analyze that on the atomic level, that's because of the light scattering off of the different atoms in the material. So loop quantum gravity does assert that space is discrete at the smallest scale, at the Planck scale. So does light traveling through that have a different speed, and might that speed, as in the case when it travels through materials, depend on energy? So might there be an energy dependence to the speed of light, which would modify, not necessarily violate, there's a subtlety here you can ask me about, but modify special relativity. And several of us got very interested in that idea and spent a lot of time on it. And it turned out to be testable because of a gamma ray burst. If you have a gamma ray burst, you have a burst of photons with a broad range of frequencies or energies lasting on the order of a second or a fraction of a second, a billion or 10 billion light years away. So as the light travels for a billion or 10 billion years, a tiny difference in speeds due to a tiny difference in energy due to this different effect will accumulate to a huge difference of about a second when it arrives on Earth. But the Fermi satellite, which was put up about 10 years ago, which was one of a series of satellites to observe gamma ray bursts, has, as with anything constructed with modern electronics, has timing of microseconds. So a timing delay of a second, if there was a systematic way in which all the very energetic photons were either came on the average a bit later or a bit earlier, if you could draw a line through them and show a linear relation, and if that linear relation had the energy over the Planck length or over the Planck energy in it, that would be the discovery of a quantum gravity effect. And that effect, that prediction, has been tested and is not there to a scale of about 10 times the Planck energy. So that is a prediction that I was very happy with and I was very happy to make, and it was wrong. At least the simplest forms of it were wrong. There's some subtlety I could talk about, but I'd rather just stand up and say that it was wrong. Now, did that kill loop quantum gravity? For worse or for better, by the time those experiments came in from the Fermi satellite, which was sort of 2005 to 2009, people in loop quantum gravity were using a different form based on Feynman's path integral approach to quantum mechanics. And that didn't predict that these effects would be there. So the prediction went away before the experiment gave a negative thing. But still, there was a form of quantum gravity theory that gave a prediction that was wrong. And that's something. It's not as nice as it might be. For what it's worth, string theory seems to generically predict that there be no such effects. The string theory is consistent with a strong version of special relativity that predicts that there's no energy dependence of the speed of light. And that's as does path integral forms of quantum gravity. So everybody's consistent with the experiments as of now, which is terrible. Yes?
I heard you say just now, loop quantum gravity use the Feynman's path integral approach to quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Does string theory not use that?
String theory, most modern theories of fields of physics use path integrals. Quantum mechanics was originally formulated about operators and states and so forth in what we call the Schrodinger or the Hamiltonian approach. And mostly that was the way that we first formulated loop quantum gravity, but mostly for relativistic theories or field theories, that's done, but more powerful are the path integral, the techniques to use Feynman path integral. For example, Feynman diagrams are mostly based on Feynman path integral techniques. Yes?
Would you say that the anthropic principle combined with multiverse theory could be used to explain away the apparent randomness of the laws of physics that we perceive?
No. Do you want me to say a few more things about that? Let me give you, the anthropic principle is often misused, and let me give you an example. Let me give you an argument that is widely credited with the anthropic principle. This is due to Fred Hoyle. Carbon is necessary for life. It happens at statement one. Statement two, listen carefully. Statement two, the universe is filled with carbon. It's one of the most common atoms in the universe. Statement three, carbon is not made in the Big Bang, therefore it must be made in stars. Statement four, carbon would not be made in stars were there not a certain coincidence between the energy levels of two nuclei, one beryllium, one carbon. So there's a certain resonance between two nuclei that leads to efficient production of carbon nuclei in stars. Okay. Therefore, there must be such a resonance and coincidence. And Hoyle and his colleagues made that prediction, I think this was 1934, I could be wrong on that. And people looked in the laboratory, Fowler at Caltech looked in the laboratory, and found the energy levels of the carbon nuclei needed to make that resonance happen. Okay. So it was claimed that there was a prediction about the energy levels of nuclear physics from a chain of logic that started with saying that the universe has life in it and carbon is necessary for life. What I've just said is fallacious. What was the fallacy? Did anybody catch the fallacy? I snuck it in there at the beginning. That's a hint. Yeah. The fact that, yeah?
The valency of carbon?
The what?
Did you ask about the valency of carbon?
No, I didn't. Yeah?
Well, we don't technically know if the universe is filled with life yet. We just know one planet is filled with life.
That's related to it, yeah?
Is carbon necessary for life?
Yeah. Right. The first statement I made, that carbon is necessary for life, may or may not be true, but plays no role in the argument. The argument starts with the observation that the universe is full of carbon, asks the question, how is that carbon made, concludes it must be made in stars because it can't be made in the Big Bang, and then concludes from some nuclear physics that carbon could not be made plentifully in stars. There weren't a certain coincidence in energy levels. Therefore, because the universe is full of carbon, it must have been made somehow, so there must be this coincidence in energy levels. The fact that we're made of carbon or life has something to do with carbon plays no role in the argument at all. Almost every time you hear the enthalpy principle invoked, there's a fallacy like that involved. In my humble opinion. Yeah?
What role do you see literature having in physics and science in terms of fictional literature like sci-fi and that sort of thing? Because I know in the 60s, people like Arthur C. Clarke had a major role in promoting science to the masses. Like hard sci-fi and hard physics. Do you see that much of a needed thing now?
Do you know what was the first science fiction book? Who wrote the first science fiction? What's credited as the first science fiction book? At least in the Western canon?
Yeah.
Who? No, a lot earlier than Mary Shelley.
H.G. Wells?
No, H.G. Wells is after Shelley, after Mary Shelley. No. No. Johannes Kepler. Johannes Kepler wrote a book in which he said that he had a dream, and in the dream, he woke up and discovered that he was the son of a witch, and that witch sold him to a sailor, and after many years, he came back to his mother, on Iceland, by the way, this was. He came back to his mother and said to her, I've come back after many years. She said, where have you been? She said, the sailor you sold me to an astronomer called Tycho Brahe, with whom I apprenticed, which is true that Kepler apprenticed with Tycho Brahe. And Tycho Brahe told me all about the stars and the moon and the planets and so forth. And his mother said, well, I'm very glad because I know all those things. I know all about the universe, but if I had told you, then you wouldn't have believed me because you don't believe in witchcraft. And he said, prove to me that your witchcraft gives you knowledge of the universe. And she made an incantation. And the demon came down and took them up to the moon. And they walked around the moon and looked at the stars. And it's the first, not only is this the first science fiction book, this is the first recorded instance of a description of the solar system as it would be from another place on Earth. That is, he describes how you would see things differently if you were on the moon rather than on the Earth. As a consequence of which, so this book was a way for Kepler to communicate his system of astronomy. It also resulted in his mother getting busted for witchcraft, which he actually was. And he had to take a year off and study law, canon law, and he defended her and got her acquitted. And there's an awful lot about in that story about the 17th century and the relationship between witchcraft and science and mysticism. And there are many books which have been written about that. But anyway, so science fiction was related to science from the beginning. I don't read a lot of science fiction, so I mean, I read Kim Stanley Robinson from time to time. I read Neal Stephenson pretty much everything he ever wrote. And I think that Neal is writing up at the people, you know him, but not everyone knows. I think he's writing about ideas which are important and which are interesting. But mostly, I read a lot of literature, but I don't read much science fiction, apart from Neal Stephenson. But Neal Stephenson did give the best portrait of Newton ever, in my view, exceeding the portraits given in biographies, in his book on the Royal Society. Yes.
Words of, like, that you would say to an aspiring
theoretical cosmologist? So I've already said some of them. But so you're going to be applying for colleges?
No, I mean, I'm really interested in cosmology too. Like, from my perspective, questions of life that arise from philosophy, or like even the reason why we exist. Like when you go deep into these thoughts, I feel like for me the only answer comes from cosmology. So
you're asking a lot of cosmology, but let me answer your question and then. So if you want to be a good working cosmologist, get a very good education. It really matters. It doesn't matter. So there are a lot of places you might go to undergraduate school. Going to a big research university is not necessarily the best thing. Small colleges. I don't know where in the world you come from.
I come from Tanzania. Like, I'm born in India, but I've been brought up in Tanzania for the last 11 years.
Okay, so I don't know the situation there. In North America, there's good universities. There are small colleges, which are also good. You want to have a good relationship with teachers. You want to find a mentor as soon as possible. You want to find teachers who can really help you and really advise you. You want to be doing research as early as possible. In other words, you need to learn the classroom stuff, but you need to go beyond the classroom stuff. You need to get connected to real research as soon as possible. As I said, and not everybody would agree with me, read the history and read the originals. Make a list of the greatest people in the history of your subject, going back as far as you can, and get them and read them. And they all wrote things, especially since before recently, there was not such a distinction between literature for the public and literature for specialists. So you can read, you don't want to read all of Newton's Principia, but you can read the opening sections and find out what he really thought about. What it was about. You can read all of Galileo. He wrote for the public. If you happen to be Italian, Galileo is one of the greatest writers in the Italian language. You can read Kepler. You can read Copernicus. Again, not all the way through, but you can read enough to find out what they did. You can certainly read Feynman. You can certainly read Einstein, Bohr, Schrodinger, Heisenberg. All these people wrote general stuff. And then since you want to be a specialist, read the papers. Start going to the library, or you don't need to go to the library anymore. Go to the. Do you all know what the archive is? Get the papers. Start reading. And by the way, while you're doing that, don't be satisfied with the curriculum. I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't learn quantum mechanics by the end of your first year of university. I mean, real quantum mechanics. There's no reason why you shouldn't learn real special relativity by now. And you should be able to learn general relativity. I mean, I had the advantage of being a dropout, so I had a lot of time on my hands. But you should be able to learn special relativity by your first or second year of college. Quantum field theory, definitely by your third year of college. If you're here, you obviously have talent. You've been picked to have talent. So, you know, when you look at the people coming into graduate school, the really good ones have had the master's level curriculum as an undergraduate. They're doing quantum field theory. They're doing graduate level condensed matter physics as undergraduates. And they've done research as undergraduates. So that's so don't read the curriculum and trust it. The curriculum is written for another age. One of the big disappointments about universities is that it takes longer than one career to move across around in the curriculum. The curriculum, the undergraduate curriculum now at most places in the world is exactly what it was 50 years ago in physics. It's not in biology. In biology, you go to freshman biology and many places you're doing recombinant experiments with DNA. So you should be doing quantum field theory in your second or third year of undergraduate school, in my view. And finally, the most important thing is take responsibility. You want to be a cosmologist? Okay, the problems are now, we hand them to you. They're now your problems. Take responsibility. They're not solved in 10 years. It's your fault. I'm serious. Being a scientist is not about being a good student and getting good grades and taking courses. Being a scientist is about making discoveries. The most important question is not what grade did you get or what books did you study. It's what are you curious about? What keeps you up at night? If you're not curious about anything, go work in finance or economics. No, I'm serious, because it's hard. No matter how bright you are, it's really hard to do this stuff. So you're going to find the motivation can only come internally. Sufficient motivation can only come internally. It can only come from what drives you crazy. What are you curious about? What keeps you up at night? What do you wake up at 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning pissed off that you don't know? Yeah.
Earlier you talked about like networks and graphs in loop quantum gravity.
Yes.
Is there any like enumeration of graphs or any just like graph theory in general involved in loop quantum gravity?
Yes, the topology of embeddings of graphs in three dimensions is a one-to-one correspondence between the quantum states of quantum gravity and the embeddings up to topology, which means braidings and knottings and so forth. And there is no enumeration of that, which might make you nervous, is one of the things that makes me very nervous. There's no classification, there's no closed-form classification of knots, which means there's no invariant that classifies the different states of quantum gravity.
So what do you mean? Like, there's no enumeration of graphs.
There's no algorithm. There's no finite algorithm, or polynomial. Let me say it more precisely. There's no polynomial algorithm. Polynomial in the number of vertices of a graph. That if I give you two embeddings of a graph in three-dimensional space, you can run the algorithm and find out if they're the same or different. In many cases, I mean, the first thing you check is the number of vertices. That's polynomial. That's just counting the number of vertices. But given that the number of vertices is the same, there's an infinite number of ways they could be braided or knotted. And there's no polynomial enumeration of that.
But polynomial enumeration, you mean like runtime or?
Yeah. So the mathematics of graphs does play a big role. And the developments of loop quantum gravity are, in fact, closely related to three- and four-dimensional topology. Yeah?
How do you suggest we approach just, like, in general, a career in theoretical physics with mathematics? Like, we talk of mathematics, you know, either studying mathematics for the sake of, you know, just the joy of learning math, and or using it as a tool for physics. So say, like in loop quantum gravity, if you want to, you know, make some sort of contribution to the field, how do you approach learning the math? Like, do you learn it as you need it, or should you get like a really broad foundation first and then?
There are different styles, and a thing that I learned very much from the experience of being part of the invention and growth of a field is people will help and contribute with very different styles. Some people are more mathematical than other people. It happened to me several times to have I can use mathematics, I have a good intuition, but I'm terrible at detailed proofs. I'm not very analytical. So it happened to me several times to intuit a result write a paper about it, which was read by the more mathematical people in my community as a statement of a conjecture, which was then proved by people using tools that I didn't have the skills to master. So different people, so I'm going to say two things. Good advice often comes in contradictory opposites. So here are two, here's an example. Learn what your style is, where strength is, and develop that. If it's a lot of pure mathematics, that's great, go for it. There's a lot of room for coming from the side of pure mathematics. If it's not, then go for that too. The advice which contradicts that is learn what your strengths are and then don't rest on that, but develop your weaknesses as well. And by the way, you didn't mention experiment, but there's great work being done, of course. Science is about experiment, and is great. I'm not an experimental physicist, but I have certainly very good friends who are, and they do great work. I don't think, by the way, that there's a kind of hierarchy which goes mathematics, theory, experiment, and that's just chauvinism of some weird kind. I mean, science needs everything to advance, yeah?
With university, do you think it's better to, for undergraduate and graduate school, do you think it's better to stay at the same school and keep building off the relationships you built in undergrad while in grad school? Or do you think it's better to change a university for like the different ideas that you could absorb from the new environment and the new professors?
I think I would answer differently for graduate school and undergraduate school. Look, graduate school is professional training. In every subfield, there's a handful of graduate schools which are the best place in the world where the world leaders are. Depending on the subfield, that's 100 or 5. Okay. You want to go, if you figure out what your field of specialization is by the time you're applying to graduate school, you want to go to a place that has a group and people that are international leaders in that specialization. You'll be way ahead if you do that. And that's very pragmatic advice, but it's the right advice career-wise. For undergraduate school, you want to go somewhere where you can, it doesn't have to be a research university, there have to be good teachers and good students, and there has to be a possibility of a lot of contact with them. If you go to a research university, that means you have to find a way to the research faculty. Research universities are very good places because there's real research being done there, and good ones, there's great research being done. But because of that, the people doing the research are hard, don't see the undergraduates very much. I mean, the last time I taught an undergraduate course, of course, I don't have to teach at all here, but before I came to Perimeter, I spent years not teaching undergraduates because they put me with graduate students to train graduate students in PhD programs. So the only way an undergraduate could get to me is by knocking on the door and asking some questions or asking for a research project. So if you go to a research university, you've got to be able to be aggressive and fight your way to the people who are doing the research and basically find some mentors there. If you're at a smaller place, but still with good teachers and good students, you have much more easy direct contact with people to mentor you. But you need one. Nobody tells you this. Well, I'm telling you this. To be a good scientist, you need one-on-one mentoring. It's like musicians get one-on-one music lessons from the age of 5 years old. Okay, there's nothing that replaces one-on-one mentoring. The classes are great, but you can have an A+ in every class. You don't make contact with a mentor, you're not going to go somewhere. So you can survive, but it's not going to be so easy. Yeah.
Talk about like physical laws can change and different approaches to quantum gravity. So what do you think about like the revolution inaugurated by people like Bronson or like physics?
What do I think about, I'm sorry?
The approach by people like Bronson in thinking about mathematics. But do you think that's useful for physics?
Grothendieck was one of the great mathematicians of our era, literally. And I've had some mathematician friends explain to me some of what he did. And it's fabulous, but it's over my head. But mathematics I love mathematics. I love learning mathematics. But again, there are people who are a lot more closely connected to pure mathematics than I am. So I'm not the best. If you're very mathematical, I'm probably not the best person to interface. Well, all I have is regret. I wish I was focused enough in pure mathematics that I could read a paper by Grothendieck. Yeah.
So I recently read a book on modern physics by Emilio Segre. And he
by who?
The modern, what?
By who?
Emilio Segre.
I don't know.
He's a physicist. And he told of the modern trend to divide the fields of science. And do you think that in certain fields of research, like, for example, the origins of life, it would be better to, instead of divide the fields, just be, like, do a collaboration between like chemists, biologists, and physicists, so that we could do more, well, have more results that way instead of focusing on smaller
fields? Yeah, and I was privileged to be part of such a collaboration back at the Santa Fe Institute in the 90s on the origin of life. And we didn't solve the problem. But there are some problems in which interdisciplinary work is really necessary, and we're not trained for it. It's really hard. It takes months and months of conversation with somebody with a different training to really. But that's not true. The first hour of a conversation can be fabulous. Second hour is pretty good. The third hour is okay. After that, you start to get into the details, and then you start to use technical language, and you can't communicate for a month. But you have to break through that. It's really, people are way too specialized. We aren't trained to do collaborations with people with different specialties, and I think that's a real problem. I think, even in this building, and we're all theoretical physicists here, it's sometimes hard to communicate. You have to really work to communicate between, say, a condensed matter physicist and a quantum gravity person. But it really pays off. It's a big investment of time, but it really pays off, in my experience. Yes? Yeah?
I have a question more about just strategy for how to become a good researcher, I guess, which is, is it better to focus on learning the most advanced things and closest to current areas of research that I'm capable of, or is it better to focus on filling gaps in my knowledge that may not be as advanced or as necessary for certain things that are kind of foundational?
Both. I'm sorry, I'm serious. You need a firm foundation. For sure you need a firm foundation. Okay. But you also want to, within some years, get to the point where you can think about original research questions. When I say you need a firm foundation, let me disagree with the curriculum. The Holiday and Resnick level, if you still use that book, the rolling balls down inclined planes, that kind of stuff, in my opinion, should not no longer be first year physics. If I was organizing a curriculum, I would make elementary quantum mechanics freshman physics, with the mathematics that comes with it, which is nothing but vectors and matrices. So you need a firm foundation, and you can do both. You can take classes with the curriculum, and you can self-study. And again, get a mentor. Go find some graduate students or some postdocs, and just say, "Can I come to you once a week and ask questions?" Most people are happy to do that. Did that help, or you wanted a more binary answer?
I'm curious to hear if you have one, but if not, then that's okay.
Maybe it may also be partly my learning style. My learning style is to go from the big picture in. So, and because I was a high school dropout, the first physics I studied was general relativity. The second physics I studied was quantum mechanics. Yeah.
Do you think that the universe exists as mathematics? And do you think that mathematics is the purest form of the universe?
No.
Then what is?
What is? I don't think the universe has any copies in any sense. I think the universe is what, the most important thing about the universe is that it's one. It is something. It is very particular what it is. It has a very particular history. It has a very particular set of laws. It may be much older than the Big Bang, but it is just what it is. And I think that mathematics is a tool that we use to describe some regularities in it. It's a brilliant tool. It's a great tool. It's a necessary tool. But I don't believe there is a mathematical object which is isomorphic to the history of the universe, such that every property that's true about nature is also true about that mathematical object. I can start off with one property that is true about nature that's not true of any mathematical object, which is that in nature, it's always some present moment. The role of time is central in the universe. Time is something which is real. The flow of time is real. The present moment is real. The succession of present moments is real. And mathematical objects are static. They're static sets of relationships between axioms. They're deducible by logic from axioms. This is my view. You ask my view. You can certainly disagree. There are many, most people disagree, but that's my view. Is there somebody who hasn't asked a question yet? Yeah.
So you mentioned you're interested in philosophy, and so I was just curious, what's your take on the trolley problem?
It matters whether one of them was my child or not, which is not the right answer. I have no deep insight into ethics. I'm interested in those aspects of philosophy that touch on the scientific problems I'm interested in. But you're not letting my child anywhere near that trolley. Somebody else who hasn't asked? Okay, again, yeah.
So what advice would you give to someone who really wants to get into physics, but that the only thing that is an obstacle is the job opportunities?
So here's something that I don't understand. But you have to remember my perspective, which is I started as a high school dropout. Physics is an opportunity to contribute to the progress of knowledge in a very fascinating aspect. I won't say it's the most, it's the best, it's not. There is a lot of other things. There's neuroscience, which is going to have fabulous progress in the next period. Biology and earth science, there are many great things. But physics, if you're curious about and suitable to it, is a privilege to contribute to the growth of knowledge. It's just true that there are more people who want to do it than there are positions for researchers, for people who support it at research universities or research institutes like this one. I am very fortunate, not even that I start off as a dropout, which I said too many times, but every day I come into work here, I feel deeply fortunate. I feel very lucky, blessed even. And I can't believe I get to work in a place like this and with the people that I work with here. So it's a privilege. Like being an artist, like being a composer, like being a dancer, like being an actor, these are all privileges to create and contribute at the highest level, like being a writer or a novelist. Most people who set out to do these things don't succeed. Because for two reasons. One, it's really, really, really hard to succeed to do something good. And two, there's a ridiculous political machine which there's lots of dysfunctional and wrong about who gets selected and everything. But let's put that, you're all too young to worry about that. Because you can't do anything about it anyway. Okay. The difference between training to be a dancer or a writer or an actor or a painter and a physicist is that if you get a degree in physics, the worst thing that happens to you is you get to work in finance on Wall Street, and you get to make $500,000 to several million dollars a year and contribute money to the scientists that you still follow. Or you get to be an engineer and go work for Microsoft and invent virtual reality tools. So it happens that you get automatically with your degree in physics what we call a back pocket trade, which if you're a dancer, an actor, or a writer, is working in a restaurant or being a bartender or being a renovator of houses. If you're trained as a physicist, you get actually quite good employment opportunities. So what's to lose? And is that Pokemon Go? Don't you? Speaking of engineers, no. So my advice is not to worry about. If you want to be any of these things I mentioned, if you want to look, there's the boundaries of knowledge are expanding in many different directions. If you want to be a rare person who contributes to the real growth of knowledge and creativity at a high level, it's a risk. You got to face it. If you're not willing to take a huge risk, don't do it, because it'll hurt when you don't get a postdoc, when you don't get into a PhD program you want. You'll get, like even the best dancers or the best actors in the world, 90% of the response to your attempts will be rejection. Okay, so you got to be risk averse. You got to have a thick skin. If you do, then don't worry about it until you find out yourself after your third postdoc without a next position but a PhD and a series of invitations to go make $200,000 a year starting salary working on Bay Street or Wall Street. Then you can worry about it. Do I make my point? Yeah.
Do you suggest getting a master's in mathematics or physics?
No. First of all, why not a PhD?
I mean, like before getting a PhD, like when you begin your first, like when you start an undergraduate, getting a major, like if you do plan on most probably getting a PhD in physics later, should you start with a major in mathematics or physics?
This is this question I answered to your colleague behind you. You got to decide who you are. Some of us they're similar skill sets, but they're different. If you want to be a mathematician, you've got to work with mathematical objects in their pure form. You've got to be able to prove theorems. The standards of work are different. What represents great work for mathematics is really different. Even if, when I collaborate with mathematics, when we invented loop quantum gravity, we collaborated with some mathematicians working on topology and knot theory and network theory and so forth. And we had ideas and they had ideas and we could develop our ideas together. But they went and wrote papers that went into math journals that had theorems and proofs in them. And I went and wrote papers that from their point of view were sloppy and had intuitions and conjectures in them. But I had physical arguments and I talked about experiments and whatever it was. So it's really interesting. They're different, as they're professionalized, they're different skill sets. Now there are people who can go back and forth between them. But find out who you are, find out where your strength is. If you can do pure mathematics at a high level, then go for it. If you can't, but you can do physics. You know, there's another thing to tell. Music has prodigies, chess has prodigies, mathematics has prodigies. These are people who start doing absolutely world-level stuff when they're 14, 15. Physics has a few people like that, but they don't succeed in the same rate. They just have a few years to catch up. Science takes judgment and a sense of intuition and contact with nature that mathematics is different from, at least as practiced the present day. So they're different, but find out where your strength is and go that direction. They're both great directions to go in. And if you happen to be somebody who's suited to do both, then more power to you, then you face a harder decision. But then you get advice from somebody who's like you, which is not me. Yeah? Anybody else? Yeah.
So going back to the loop quantum gravity for a second. So you said that loop quantum gravity describes gravity in a quantized way.
Yes.
But you also said that loop quantum gravity and all we have to date has not succeeded in unifying quantum mechanics. and graph general relativity. So I guess where does loop quantum gravity fail to unify the two? Is it just the lack of falsifiable predictions? Or?
Mostly.
Okay.
No, and you know, my friend Carlo Rovelli, we spent a lot of time together the last few weeks. He has a more confident attitude. He says, look, we don't know that this is the framework for quantum gravity, but it could be. It's mathematically consistent. It gives finite answers where quantum field theory usually gives infinite answers. It describes a clean notion of what of a result from quantizing general relativity. It satisfies many tests. Black holes have entropy, and they have the right entropy up to the right factor of 1/4. There's gravitational waves. There's cosmology. Comes out looking pretty right. There's a lot of things that go right. But my sense is that the proper standard for when have we accomplished something with a theory is when it makes predictions which are unique and falsifiable, and those predictions have been tested and held up. And we haven't done that. We thought we did that, as I described. We had an early naive form of the theory which made some predictions which have not stood up. But in any case, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately, I would like, if that had been the end of the story, then I would be very proud of having invented a theory that was falsified. It's not as good as inventing a theory that made falsifiable predictions that was confirmed, but it's the second best. But the honest story is that the theory developed and those predictions turned out to be too naive. And now we're left in a situation where we haven't any predictions whose testing is underway. And I deeply regret that. Deeply, deeply, deeply. Like, get out of here. You know, this is like the worst thing that could happen. Because it's the worst thing that could happen because you want to know, you know, I happen to be privileged with the two friends that I mentioned to be part of inventing a theory, which might be a theory of nature. And that's a great privilege, and I'm grateful for that. But I don't want that to be true just so I can get the legacy from that. I want to know what the answer is. I went into this because I want to know those questions that Einstein asked when I read when I was 17 on that porch. I want to know how gravity and quantum theory go together, how space-time and quantum theory go together. I want to know how to make sense out of quantum mechanics. I want to know how physics is unified. And I want to know the answer. If the answer is something else, I'd be very happy to know. If the answer is string theory, I'm happy. I have nothing against string theory, except it doesn't make any predictions either. If the answer is causal dynamical triangulations, which my friends Renata Lowell and Jan Omborn developed, then that's great. I'm happy. You know, if the answer is causal sets, which my friends Faye Dauker and Raphael Sorkin, we're all friends. You know, as long as, or maybe the answer is something that one of you invented that's not on the table yet. But I want to know before too long what the answer is. Yes.
I've just read a few times now, and I can't remember where, so it might have just been Popular Science Blog, I'm not too sure. But I've read a few articles on the possibility or even the likelihood of artificial intelligence and supercomputing taking over physicist research positions, especially in theoretical physics, where advanced manipulation of calculations is needed to just find links between ideas we currently have and observations we currently see. And do you think that this would ever be a likely event we would see?
I would say not soon, if ever. Recently, artificial intelligence due to deep networks has made a lot of progress that I wouldn't have expected. So I'm not quite as confident in dismissing that as I used to be. But let me say what I am confident of. The brain gives rise to a mind somehow. The brain is something that's part of nature, therefore is understandable. It operates under some principles. We will come to comprehend them, I hope. I'm pretty confident that the principles by which a brain gives rise to a mind are not on the table yet. I'm pretty confident they won't look like the principles by which a programmable digital computer works. So I don't think that developing, and I know many people disagree, but I don't think that further developments in computation of the same kind that we have now is going to lead to an understanding of what a mind is, or the invention of an artificial mind. Again, people disagree. You know, I've talked with Larry Page, who's the co-founder of Google. He thinks that what Google is about is they're making a mind, and that's why they're fortunate to have the largest network of servers in the world, because they envision a mind emerging from that. And he's not kidding, speaking of reading science fiction. So there are lots of powerful people who disagree. Silicon Valley is full of crazy people who think that they're making minds. But I'm more conservative, and I think that the minds will be explicable, but not on the same principles that digital program, that von Neumann machines work. That's my view. But I wouldn't have guessed that they could play Go ever. So how about two? I see two, so two last questions.
Yeah, okay, so I read that on the gravity predicts, makes predictions about cosmology. So, for example, about a positive cosmological constant, so about the accelerating expansion of the universe. And I was just curious as to where the link is between what you have explained and such cosmological predictions.
I don't think loop quantum gravity predicts that there is a that the cosmological constant is positive. Loop quantum gravity is consistent with a positive cosmological constant. And there was a point, there was a time when we made that point, because there was a time when string theory wasn't, and there was a dark energy which had been observed. So I kind of made that point in a few papers. Then people figured out how to make string theory allegedly consistent with the positive cosmological constant, the small cost of coming in an infinite number of different versions. There is one pretty robust result in cosmology, which is that the initial singularity is eliminated. So the time goes back before the initial singularity in some region, some period of the universe that goes back in history. That's been shown, again, by Abhay Ashtekar and a bunch of other people many different ways by now, and I think it's a pretty robust result. Okay, last question.
Out with general relativity, but like, how did you do that? Because like the math in general relativity was like super advanced, and like you just like start off.
I told you how I did it. So I got told in eighth or ninth grade that I wasn't smart enough to do advanced mathematics. So I had a friend of my parents who was a mathematician. I went and complained about this to him, and he said, "Come to summer school at my university over the summer, and we'll get you all through the next years of high school math and take calculus the next year." So I took calculus in ninth grade. Just as an act of rebellion. I wasn't interested in it, I didn't think, but just as an act of rebellion. So that gave me a framework. The next year I took multidimensional calculus. Then I dropped out. Then I started studying. I told you the story. I started studying the architecture based on the idea of architecture based on curved surfaces. So I had to learn the math of differential geometry, which is in the geometry of arbitrarily curved surfaces. So I went to the library and got books on that, which were graduate level math textbooks in differential geometry. But I was
geometry in like 2 years?
What?
You finished learning differential geometry in like 2 years or less?
It's not that hard. It's not. Oh, come on. Kids do all kinds of things these days.
Less than 2 years,
it's
like 1 year or something.
No. When I learned differential geometry, I think I was 16 when I taught myself. And again, I'm sloppy. I'm a fast learner. I learn intuition principles. I mean, I couldn't have proved the Pythagorean theorem, but I could compute, you know, derivatives and metrics and connections and Riemann curvature tensors.
On another note, are like Riemann curvature tensors like also differential geometry, right?
Yeah. It's all the mathematics of general relativity. So when I read that essay by Einstein and I wanted to learn what general relativity was about, I was very lucky. I happened having that my high school rebellion, plus my interest in architecture, plus my chance meeting of Buckminster Fuller, had taken me to the point where I learned exactly the math I need to know to learn general relativity. Let me tell you what happened when I went to, when I finally talked my way into a real college. They said, okay, we're going to give you an exam on this stuff. And I said, okay. And they said, what do you know about general relativity? And I said, well, here's the metric of the Schwarzschild metric, the metric of a spherically symmetric black hole. And I wrote down the blackboard, and they said, it has a symbol ds squared. And he said, fine, what are the dimensions of ds squared? What are the units of ds? And I said, what does that mean? And they said, you flunk. Because I didn't know the base. I'd never taken a physics course. I didn't know how to think about units or dimensions or anything. But it turned out that the guy who flunked me in that exam was a great teacher, and I got a great teacher. Again, I got really lucky. Last thing, what that great teacher did more than anything else is he forced me to do all the problems at the end of the books that we were studying. And so, you know, part of the answer is you got to get the foundation, you got to do the homework, you got to do the problem sets. You can't just talk yourself into the fact that you understand it because you think you understand the concepts when you read. You got to do the problem sets. And you got to also get the advanced stuff. Okay, thank you guys.